Hi, today I have with me Flip Nicklin, who is probably the go-to guy for National Geographic whenever they want to take photos or do a photo assignment with cetaceans. I've known Flip's name since I was a kid. I think actually Flip is the reason, or one of the biggest reasons, I got started with nature photography and interested in whales specifically. So Flip has just launched a new book called Among Giants, which covers much of his experience with cetaceans, and we're going to talk about that and find out, for those of you who are interested, where you can get that book. Flip, perhaps to get started, could you tell me or tell the audience actually how you got started with cetaceans and what your interest was in the beginning?
I grew up in San Diego, and from the time I was 11 years old, we had a dive shop in Pacific Beach. And in the 60s, in January in 1963, my father was out with a bunch of his diving buddies diving for lobsters. He had just inherited a couple still camera and a movie camera, and they found a whale entangled in the anchor line to a gill net. They jumped in, swam around it, took pictures of it, took movies of it. And at the end, my father got on the back of the whale and actually had a picture taken with him waving at the camera. I think thinking this would be a good advertising possibility for the dive shop. That picture was published in San Diego and around the country. It led to a whole bunch of things, including him being asked to come back to New York to be on a celebrity TV show called To Tell the Truth. And when they showed that show, Bates Littlehales from National Geographic saw it. Bates was the underwater guy for National Geographic in the 50s and the 60s and in the 70s, and was just thinking about doing wild whale stories. And he saw the stuff my father had and got in touch with him. He was looking for whale experts. My dad was a whale expert. He'd seen one. And that started the whole show going.
Right. So that was, you said 1963. Is that right?
Yes, 1963, before Save the Whales or any of the stuff had started. We were still in the U.S. actively commercial whaling, and a whole different time.
Right. So I guess it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that you've seen the entire, I guess, cultural view of whales or cetaceans in general change quite dramatically in the time that you've been associated with this area?
No, I think that's a big part of what my family has been into, I think, coming into it. Whales were monsters when they were seen by Alexander the Great's men going across the Mediterranean. They were seen as this monstrous shapes like small islands on fire with the blows looking like smoke, you know. And it went from there to being a commodity, and for a long, long time, whales were just another product. They were really the oil business till the end of the Civil War. And I think when my dad came in the early 60s, it was right on the buffer of a change, and going from commodity to the myth and magic of whales that Save the Whales movement was all about. And I didn't really get involved until the end of the 70s, 1979. And when I came in, what really caught my interest was I was doing production stills on an IMAX film that my father was a cameraman on. And the whales were great, and the diving was great, and the free diving with whales was really spectacular off of Hawaii. But what really caught my interest were this more than a dozen graduate students who were taking myth and magic of whales and changing it into the biological study of whales and what whales really do. And basically, for the last 30 years with Geographic, I covered the stories of these graduate students and people trying to learn about whales.
So are you still dealing with some of the same people today?
I still, the first person I worked with under Roger Payne's permit was Dr. Jim Darling, a graduate student at the time, and I still work with Jim. And actually, Jim and I founded a nonprofit in Hawaii called Whale Trust in 2001. But I still work with Jim every year.
Right, right. That's great. That's a very must have been a very productive relationship.
It has been. And Jim, I just saw Greg Silber, who's another one of the young people that we worked with, who's now in Silver Spring, Maryland, with NOAA, coordinating research on large whales. A bunch of those folks who were doing it, you know, in small boats with no money, trying to figure out how to look at whales, are now leaders in the field. And going back and working with those same folks decades later has a really good feel to it.
Yeah, it must. It must. Can you, you know, in this 30-some-odd year time span, can you bring this back to yourself? And what was the biggest change for you? I mean, when you started back in, you said 1979, I'm sure there were thoughts in your head, your own views on whales. And now when you look today, what's the biggest change for you?
I really hadn't thought very much about whales. One of the things I thought, and one of the things, the reaction I got the first time I proposed a whale story to National Geographic in 1980, was that all the stuff had been done. My father had worked on a couple stories with Bill Kurtzinger. They'd done three or four whale stories at that point. My dad was part of the first wild whale story in 1972 on right whales in Patagonia. And we hadn't even started yet. And I kid people who come along and work on whales, going, maybe your high point in your knowledge about whales is after 9 or 10 days. And after that, there's always more questions than answers, but you keep wanting to go out and find a few more answers.
Right. Well, on that note, right now in your career, what are the, or are there any remaining big questions or things that you've been looking into that you still want to figure out that keeps you going?
Oh, there. We've just begun. One of the great descriptions of where we are now was that maybe in the last 30 years, we've discovered a new continent and the next generation gets to find out what's in the interior. But no, we know a little bit about gray whales and humpback whales and kidder whales, you know, the large dolphins and a few of those species. But of the 80 plus species, we know a little bit about a very few.
How many have you seen personally?
I think I've seen around 40. And I was just talking to Bob Pittman, who's another great whale photographer, and he's seen 80 species, which is amazing to me.
That is amazing. I mean, can you give people an idea of how difficult that is? I mean, just to, say, find one particular type of whale.
Well, it starts off easy. I mean, humpback whales, right whales, sperm whales, gray whales, a number of the animals, especially bottlenose dolphins, kidder whales, animals that are whale watching is built around, are fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. But you get past about 20 and it starts getting to be much more interesting. And then there are things like a pygmy right whale that I don't know if anybody's ever seen one. You know, it's there are a number of the ziphids, the beaked whales, that we've never seen alive. We've only seen them tangled up in nets and things. So it is a lot out there. And I was never that excited about cataloging. And if I had my druthers, I'd stick with a half a dozen whales we've built a beginning on, especially humpback whales, and try and make a model so we can apply it when we start figuring out what other species are doing.
Right, right. Yeah. So can you give me an example of, let's say, one of your most, this is sort of a cop-out question, but one of your most memorable experiences with a humpback whale or a sperm whale or whichever whale you happen to have a particularly strong impression of?
Well, I'll start out with humpback whales. The first thing I did that had anything to do with science with whales was in 1979 on March 10th, and we knew that humpback whales sang, and we knew the whales that were singing. Jim Darling and his crew had figured out which whales were singing by the timing and the recordings and when they slowed down, when they surfaced. They had IDs of the whales. They were starting to take the tail pictures that were like a fingerprint of the whales. But on March 10th, 1979, they saw a whale after it had dived down. And they figured that they just kept swimming around in the dark somewhere. But they looked down through the slick, the footprint, the smooth spot where the whale had dived down, and could see the whale 50 or 60 feet down below sitting there singing. And that's where I came in. They called me over, and I was a pretty good freediver, and asked if I could dive down under the tail of the whale and take a picture of its genitals. And then if I could do that, I know if, you know, I'm you know, 29 years old, and it was all pretty exciting stuff. And so I said, sure, I'll give it a shot. And with an Iconos, dive down, and it was really loud. I mean, like jet engine loud as you're going past the tail, going under the tail, and we're at 60 or 70 feet or so, and trying to be fairly close to get the picture. And I was just taking the picture, and I saw the tail of the whale start to come up. And I just had this vision he was going to pound me into the sand down there, and it wasn't that at all. But apparently he felt a tickle of bubbles or something going up as I went down below him, and was just looking back under his pectoral fin to see what was back there, and then settled down and kept on singing. But it was a heck of a start, you know. That study led us to find out that the singers were males. And if we could find out what the males were doing, it was just one little step forward in trying to figure out how their whole social system has worked out.
Yeah, were those pictures in Nat Geo by any chance?
Yeah, that I came back the next year and continued working on that.
Mm-hmm.
And as a volunteer sleeping on the couch with the researchers, and I got a call from Mary Smith, who is the liaison between research and the magazine, saying not to cause any trouble, that any pictures I took, they got to look at because they were funding part of the research, which was great with me. And we sent the stuff in, and I was getting some, not just the pictures of genitals, but also I was getting in some interesting situations as I did the science. And after she saw that, she said I should come back to the magazine after I was done. And that led to a story in April of 1982, which was my first whale story in the magazine.
That could have been the story that I saw, that I remember a photo that you took of, I think it probably was a singer hanging down, and you took it from about the top of the tail, looking down into the blue.
Yep.
And that's,
there are a lot of those.
yeah. That's probably, well, it was one of the photos that got me started. What about other types of whales? Are there any others that left a strong impression on you?
Oh, they're all, and I think especially the first one. I mean, well, the first thing I did was humpback whales for the magazine, and then some of the same people who were working on the humpback study were also studying kittle whales in Vancouver Island. And this is 1981, 1982. So I fought to get that story. And I remember when I said I wanted to cover it, they said, no, they thought they could get it all from stock photos. But if I could do anything underwater, then that might lead to something. And there was a place called the Rubbing Beaches where kittle whales came into shallow water and rubbed themselves on smooth stones. So and I'd seen pictures from above water of this, and went up there with Dr. John Ford and Graham Ellis, who now work for the government in Western Canada, working with killer whales. And there was a spot where you went in, and all these whales came in to scratch themselves, but you couldn't go in the water. If you just put your foot in the water, they'd all leave. But I found a crack and a crevice where I could sneak in, and I thought if I crawled down to the bottom and, again, snorkeling, crawled out to the area where they were, they might allow it. But it was really exciting. And kittle whales were still kittle whales in 1981. There's no free willy type approach to the whole thing. And you're looking down, and all these black and white shapes are going around down below you. And I'm asking the guys if this is going to be okay. And they're going, oh, yeah, they're not going to think you're a seal. There's different kinds of kittle whales, but the line that I think John Ford had was, they're not going to hurt you by mistake, which really I would have liked a little bit more. But I went down, I snorkeled down, I crawled out to the bottom, I started taking pictures, and I probably did that 20 different occasions and never even had one look at me. I think I had one calf maybe look at me, and the rest of them just went by doing their regular stuff. And that was always sort of my goal, was to shoot behavior, not change it. And I was really getting sold on the whole free diving idea of the way of covering this stuff at the time. But every time I went from there to sperm whales to narwhals, and each time it was a big adventure. There was always really hard to find them because all the science was pretty new. I think when I did sperm whales, I spent 6 months to shoot 4 rolls of film underwater. And that was 1983 and 1984. When I did the second story I did for Geographic on sperm whales in 1995, I got more good stuff in the first 3 days than I did in those 6 months, just because the science had kept moving forward and we knew so much more about the animals.
Right. Right. Wow. Wow. That's pretty amazing. I mean, I can just, when you said, don't worry, the whales, or when they told you the whales won't hurt you by mistake, the natural thing to wonder would have been, would they hurt you intentionally?
Yeah, I did think about that.
Yeah, exactly. So I assume that you've covered a lot of this in your books, or in your new book, right, Among Giants?
Well, that's pretty much what it's about. It's largely a changing view of whales. My family had been involved for a long time. There had been gray whales in San Diego. I grew up in San Diego. And mm-hmm. in the South Bay in San Diego, there have been young gray whales in there a couple times in the last few years. And about 3 years ago, they ran a story from 1887 from the San Diego Union. And it was by an Irishman that had come as a whaler in the 1840s. And he talked about that there were so many gray whales in the South Lagoons in San Diego Bay, which was one of the breeding lagoons at the time, that it was unsafe to take a small boat across to a freshwater spring.
Wow.
And that was Philip Crosthwaite, and that was my great-great-grandfather. Right. So we figure he was the first whale expert in the family.
Wow. Wow. It's hard to imagine so many whales.
And the most recent story, there was just a little whale hit by a speedboat. You know, so it's gone from so many whales you couldn't take a boat in to so many boats it's hard for a whale to be there. And that's probably our next phase with whales. As some of these whales make recovery, what will we do and what will our relationship be, as it's not just us and an endangered species, but us and a recovering species that needs resources of its own.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, I guess, can you tell us a little bit about your book, like how it's structured and how many photos are in there?
Oh, geez. It's 192 pages or so. And I don't know, maybe there's 150 pictures. I don't think I've ever counted them. But it's going to take you through a change in time. And it starts out with the story of my father riding the whale and pictures in there from my dad on the back of the whale, and goes through, it starts out the early days, some of the methodologies and trying to work with science. It goes from there to sort of new era where, you know, we were just trying to show not that there were different kinds of whales, but whole different worlds of whales as we looked out there. It goes into a chapter on Arctic work, and it wasn't linear, but we tried to put it together in that way. And I spent about 10 years doing stories in the high Arctic, and narwhals and belugas and bowheads and things. It moves into the 90s talking about issues in whales, and it got to be not just study of whales and numbers of whales, but what's happening with man and whales, more interactive stuff with whales, and ends with a sort of the future, what will happen with us in the future with whales.
That sounds amazing. Where can people find the book, or how can people buy it?
The way I'd love for them to get the book would be to go on whaletrust.org. That's our nonprofit.
Okay.
And mainly because money there, that's how the most money gets into research from the book. But it's available in bookstores. It's available online from a number of sources. If you look up Among Giants, A Life with Whales, or even just Flip Nicklin, the book will pop up pretty easily.
Okay, but your preferred venue or outlet is whaletrust.org.
Whaletrust.org is a great way to go. And if you want to see the book, especially if you have an iPad, it's also an app. So you can go onto iTunes and get Among Giants, A Life with Whales for, I think it's less than $10 to see what you're getting into.
Okay, and is that the entire contents of the book?
I think it's most of it. And actually, there's some things in there that aren't in the book. Like there's video from Jason Sturgis of some of the humpback whale stuff we do. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice look, and it gets you most of the feeling of the book.
Great. That's fantastic. So either hardcover via whaletrust.org or soft copy on the iPad via the iTunes store.
Well, exactly. And actually, if you go only at Whale Trust, there are actually two versions. And the one we're saving sort of for Christmas, we've already gone through most of them. There's a special version that's a limited edition 800 signed and numbered in a sleeve with special cover. And those you can just get through whaletrust.org.
Excellent. And how much is the book, the hardcover and the special edition?
The regular hardcover trade is $40. The special edition is $75.
Excellent.
And just about all the extra money goes to research.
Excellent. Well, and I'll be putting in an order for the special edition.
Oh, good.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time, Flip. I appreciate it. Especially
my pleasure.
Getting you online and doing this online. So I hope you have many more years of doing this, and hope to run across you someday out in the field.
Hope to meet you. It'd be fun. I'm going to be at DEMA this year just to meet folks.
Oh, okay. I unfortunately won't be there, but I'm sure I'll run across you at some point.
Sure thing.
Okay. Bye-bye. Take care, Flip. Thanks.